Hello everyone and welcome to this new episode of The Burning Case. With only a few days to COP26, where thousands of delegates, activists, but also corporations and interest groups will be discussing the future of humanity on Earth, quite literally, we thought we'd dive into the UK's government claim to, quote, deliver the most inclusive COP ever. For a few months now, there's been an extremely strong backlash from many activists and frontline communities on this claim, and it looks like the UK government won't be able to deliver on its promise. So to better understand what's at stake, I'm very, very happy to welcome Aisha Siddiqa, co-founder and executive director of the Polluters Out campaign. Hi Aisha, thank you so much for taking the time a few days before COP. I know it's hectic. How are you feeling?
Thank you so much for having me, Chloe. How am I feeling? I think I personally am very frustrated with the operations of attending COP, and I am not even going to get into what is occurring during the conference. But right now, just so that the listeners know, prices for plane tickets have skyrocketed in the past 2 weeks. What I am in New York City, which should have been a $300 ticket, is now up to $1,400. Hotel accommodations in Glasgow have reached ridiculous, one could say criminal heights. People are charging over the top fees just to house people. And this is supposed to be a conference about climate justice. And time again, the thing that I'm finding that runs through all of these COPs is that they are unjust.
Yeah, absolutely. And you touched upon, I think, one of the key challenge of accessibility to this COP. It's the cost. It's extremely high. Can you maybe quickly touch base on also another big challenge that's preventing a lot of people from attending the COP, and it's the limited access to COVID-19 vaccines in certain regions and travel restrictions and quarantine. I don't know if you, coming from the US, for instance, you have to quarantine and then pay your hotel yourself if you're quarantining.
That's a very important insight. COVID restrictions are not just very inaccessible. They're quite odd. The United States, I don't need to quarantine. I just need a vaccination card and I need a PCR test.
The US is COVID cases are over the roof. It's actually dangerous to be in the United States as opposed to other countries. But most Global South countries are the ones that are having the most difficulty getting in to the UK because it's not just a vaccination, it's a type of vaccination. And as if you know, we have a monopoly over the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines. And so people are not just being left out because they can't afford it. They're being left out because their governments were not lucky enough to get access to Pfizer. And that's just like another inequity aspect.
Yeah. And I mean, what do you think about the supposedly efforts that the UK government and COP26 organization made recently? I mean, I was reading that now they announced that both vaccinated and unvaccinated delegates, observers and media from red list countries would be allowed to enter with the quarantine time in hotels paid for by the UK government, and at the same time that they would be sending vaccines to delegates who might not otherwise have access to them. But the problem is, apparently, they didn't start shipping the vaccines until September 3rd. Like, what do you think about that? It sounds really absurd.
See, honestly, I don't even know if this was able to go into fruition because many of my friends who are in red zone countries and Global South countries are struggling just to get their visas. So I can't even comment on the fact that the UK government was going to host them and send them vaccines, because from the looks of it, they didn't do that. And I don't know who that went to. Did it go to politicians? Did it go to activists? Did it go to wealthy delegates? I don't know.
Yeah, and visa, you just mentioned visa, and it's also one of the main challenge that so many people are encountering at the moment. Do you think that all of this means that historically it's one of the hardest COP to attend, or do you think it's usually pretty hard already to attend a COP event for activists, and especially activists in the Global South.
This is definitely one of the hardest COPs to attend. This is definitely one of the most inequitable COPs. Half of it is a result of deliberate actions taken by the UK government, and the other half is because of the pandemic. We knew that if the COP was going to occur during the pandemic, getting there initially would have been difficult just in of itself. But in a first world country, in a country that has one of the highest currencies, the pound, in a nation that is, you know, historically the hub of empire, of course it's difficult for Global South people to get there. And even those of us that are from Global North countries are having equity issues, are having difficulty affording housing and food and flights. The dollar, for example, I need more dollars to make a pound. And so every time I spend money in England, it costs me twice as much. And now take that and apply it to a country like Uganda. £1 is equivalent to around 2,000 Ugandan dollars. So it is not just about getting there. It is literally, we're talking about financial inequity. And that was not the case necessarily in Europe, even because the euro is cheaper. So like, it is a really, really odd situation.
Yeah. And what do you think about the calls that have happened to delay the event? So there was a coalition of 1,500 green organizations, as well as a coalition of 48 indigenous and civil society groups that sent letters to leaders calling for the conference to be delayed. And then at the same time, there were other groups that kind of fought back on this idea to delay the conference by saying, you know, we can't afford for it to be delayed even more. We need it to happen now, no matter how imperfect it is. What do you think about that?
I think there's both valid arguments on both sides. However, the position of saying delay the conference kind of like implies that things occur at the conference that are absolutely necessary for progress in the climate sphere. Like, it implies that legislation is coming out of the conference, policies are coming out of the conference, which is not the case. Everything is decided beforehand. COP is literally just a formality. So there's just talks. So delaying the conference is not going to do anything about the fact that they have been meeting for the past 300 days without civil society. And then the other thing is, like, it's also a place of privilege because you can say, like, for example, nations who are not necessarily having climate damage right now can say, hold back the conference, I suppose. But island nations are running on a year basis. They will be flooded in 6 years completely. So I don't think it was a matter of like, we need this conference to occur no matter how imperfect it is. I think it was more of, we need robust mitigation policies to come out ASAP. And the thing is, they could have come out without 300,000 people showing up to Glasgow.
Yeah, and it's not just because something was discussed at COP, as you were saying, that it's going to be implemented. And you're completely right. All the policies and the actual legally binding commitments happen outside of COP. And what do you think about the possibility of holding a COP online? Do you think, from your experience, is it doable? Is it preferable? Would it have given more access to more people? Or would the issue of digital access have been a major barrier to access to COP if it had been online?
So I have two answers for this. First of all, I think it would not have been completely inaccessible. We're not talking about a small university, we're not talking about even a small nation. We are talking about the United Nations. They have funding, they have resources, and if anybody should have been able to pull a digital conference off, it could have been the UN. So I think, like, excuses about, We can't get all of the delegates there because internet and access send them a device, like a for a few days, let them borrow it. You have the funds. If you can fly in people from all over the world, if you can house people from all over the world, you can definitely help somebody get a $30 to $50 access to an iPad to attend the conference. So I think that in and of itself is just ridiculous. I don't entertain that, but I think it could have been possible. I think that even last year it could have been possible. They just didn't do it. And I'm going to actually say that the UN was lazy. And I'm also going to say that there was actually deliberate attempts to postpone it because they didn't want to have it, because they didn't want to deal with it. So I think this conference could completely have been digital if they tried hard enough. Like if my small school in New York City can get its students all online, the UN could have done that as well. Now, as far as its effectiveness goes, I'm also of the opinion that the conference is just people talking. I mean, yes, it would have been hard to network, and yes, you would have lost some of the ambiance, but it's essentially the same thing if you have it online. It's just people talking.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if you remember, but a bunch of youth actually set up an online conference to quote replace the COP last year, Mock 26, and it happened, and it happened in a matter of a month, and they managed to include youth from all over the world. So you're right, it could definitely have happened. So what does it mean? We've talked about the challenges to access the COP for civil society, for activists. Concretely, what does it mean? Who's going to be able to attend the COP then, and specifically the inside of the COP, you know, that famous blue zone where the discussions and the negotiations and the networking, as you mentioned, is happening? Who's left?
So, very selective few. The conference will be between people who are privileged enough to afford vaccines, privileged enough to afford expensive flights to the UN, who are lucky enough to find lodging. There are currently 3,000 people who have badges who don't have places to live in Glasgow because all of the housing has been occupied. And I think it is a showcase of inequity at the finest. It really, really does put the climate crisis into perspective. The blue zone, in my opinion, if we can put this in metaphorical terms, is like the safe zone. People who have resources and an abundance of them can get in. And also, a lot of COP is like knowing people. It's not even about the work you do. You know somebody who knows somebody who can get you in. It is very unjust in that way. So many, I know hundreds of thousands of people are going to be outside protesting. And it's going to be white men in their suits inside. It's going to be the CEOs of oil companies. It's going to be politicians from governments who have been throwing people in jail for fighting for climate justice, but they're going to be at COP. Even the activists that do get in, they are also being helped by groups, by NGOs who have the funding. And the NGO list of COP, if you look at it, are also groups that are uncomfortable calling them out. So they're very selective of who they let in because they don't want groups who completely destroy their integrity to be inside. And lastly, if you protest, when you sign the contract, if you protest, they are under all legal authority to remove your badge. So one wonders why for the past 30 years nothing has happened at COP. Well, they legally bind you not to call them out.
I remember in Madrid when some activists protested and they were immediately removed from the premises. You touch base on the CEOs of all corporations. So let's talk a little bit about that. How's the presence of fossil fuel corporations in this COP? Is it more than before? Is it less than before? Do you think it's pretty similar? And can you maybe explain a little bit to our audience essentially how and why is the UN allowing fossil fuel corporations to attend the conference on climate? I mean, I think for a lot of people who are in the climate movement, we're aware of that, but just saying those words, I think saying them makes no sense. So maybe for the ones that aren't part of the climate movement, can you explain a little bit why and how are they allowed to attend?
Yeah, so I'll break it down in very simple terms. Scottish Power, the UK's biggest polluter, is sponsoring. By sponsoring, I mean financially funding COP. Shell, the world's seventh largest polluter and one of UK's biggest polluter, is sponsoring COP. Just until recently, so was BP. The only reason BP was removed by a sponsor is because the UN did a little bit of research and their goals to go net zero by 2050 are impossible with the trajectory that they're on. So the UN called their bluff, and so BP will no longer be there. Executives from all the oil companies will definitely be there, whether they're sponsoring the conference or not. So compared to other COPs, like in Madrid, it was sponsored by Iberdrola, and the IETA also had, which it, oil companies who were doing panels there. I think it is one of the most corrupt COPs because the British Petroleum, Scottish Power, and Shell are all Global North companies. And the UK is wealthy enough to do this on its own. It does not need to collude with oil companies to host it, especially they are making ridiculous amounts of revenue from hosting this. It is literally an Olympic game because nations put bids on who will get to host the COP primarily because they know there's revenue in it. People are flying in, spending millions of dollars flying in, billions to stay, food, like it is a Coachella for world leaders without the fancy, without the nice bits. So, and then as far as sponsoring goes, so financially they're sponsoring the creation of this, and because they have a stake in sponsoring, they're actively doing line edits to the Paris Climate Agreement. There's backdoor meetings where they are lobbying governments to say that the climate crisis or the use of fossil fuels is not bad. Governments are lobbying the UN to say that they are actually on target when they're not. Governments like Saudi Arabia, Japan, and Australia. There's a lot of corruption happening. So in simple terms, we have the people who caused the crisis being extinction of mankind, sponsoring a conference that's supposed to help us mitigate the extinction of mankind, and forcing themselves in. And not only that, it's like the wolf who like ate the rest of your family is being invited for dinner again. It absolutely makes no sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for breaking that down for us and for the audience. And what do you think needs to happen in order to make this impossible? You know, make those links between decision makers and fossil fuel corporations impossible. Back in the days, the World Health Organization kicked out tobacco producers and cigarette manufacturers out of conference on the impacts of tobacco. And it took a long time, but in the end, they weren't allowed to attend anymore. So it has been done in the past. There is a precedent. Why isn't this happening at the UN level? And how can we make this happen? How can we make sure that these ties don't exist anymore?
So Polluters Out is pushing for exactly that, a conflict of interest policy that is signed by the nations that make up the UN. It is signed by the UNFCCC, the people that host COP, and the fossil fuel companies, the people who sponsor it. And the reason why it is not happening is because, first of all, most of the policies that come out of COP are non-binding. Nobody faces repercussions for defining or stepping out or denying. And no one, I mean nations, faces repercussions from not doing what they promised to at the UN. So that's another reason why nobody like takes it seriously. The other thing is countries like the US, like the UK, where the oil companies are housed, don't want to sign it. The G7 nations, the ones with a huge amount of voting power, are the ones that are pushing us to not sign this conflict of interest policy, which, by the way, activists have been pushing for decades now. This is not something new that Polluters Out or other groups that have recently arose have kind of come up with. Activists have been pushing it, and the nations that do want to sign it are the island nations, are the small nations, and the nations that are being destroyed by the climate crisis. They want a conflict of interest policy yesterday. The ball isn't being moved by big nations and global north nations.
And so my last question is twofold, actually. How can people who are listening to this help support the Polluters Out campaign, support such commitments, such policies to make sure that conflict of interest don't happen anymore? But also, how do you think people can help amplify MAPA voices that won't necessarily be present at COP or that are trying to attend but can't because of all the challenges that we have been discussing? What can people do?
How can you help MAPA people who can't attend, who might have a bad finances, money? Seriously, that is the answer that is like the most effective. Donate. There are so many people who are doing fundraising campaigns. I can list them right now who need money just to get a plane ticket to get to Glasgow. Give them your money. It goes a long, long way. The other thing, how can Polluters Out, or how can you support Polluters Out? There are going to be half a dozen protests happening outside of COP. The thing that shifts COP, the thing that has previously gotten the Paris Climate Agreement, were not these men, fancy men in suits talking to each other. It was pressure from civil society. We are the reasons. We are the people who are going to save ourselves. So if you can get to Glasgow, if you can protest there, do it. If you can do it in front of your own UN hub or office, do it. Get involved with other people on any day from the 1st to the 14th. Have a campaign and have messages like Polluters Out, like we need a conflict of interest policy. And then lastly, I think on our website actually is a petition that we're appealing to the executive secretary of the UNFCCC, Patricia Espinosa, asking her and the UNFCCC to demand a conflict of interest policy. You can sign that petition. But at TED previously and in my work for the past 5 years in the climate movement and past 2 years with Polluters Out, one thing that has resonated with me is all the scientists and the leaders of the world nations telling me and telling Polluters Out to give them hell at COP. Mary Robinson, the seventh president of Ireland, came up to myself and the youth climate movement and said, give them hell. And I think this is a promise we intend on keeping.
And just to conclude on that, I just wanted to quote on a new report that came out today by Fossil Free Politics, which is a European coalition that demands, as it name stands fossil free politics, that there had been 71 revolving door cases involving the public sector, such as national government and agencies, the EU and international institutions, and just 6 big energy firms and 5 of their lobby groups between 2015 and 2021. And then there were 568 meetings with top-level officials from the European Commission between 2015 and 2021. So that's an average of 1.5 meetings every week on a 7-year period. And they spent 170 million euros lobbying in Europe. So this is not just happening at COP, it's happening everywhere. It's happening at every level of decision making. There is a very strong lobbying from the fossil fuel industry in order to influence decision making. So let's not be foolish. Let's be aware of that. It is happening, and we need to do everything in our power to make sure that we have fossil free politics that then actually make the right decisions when it comes to our future on this planet. So thank you so much, Aisha, for taking the time. I know you're super busy at the moment. Thank you for all you're doing, and I hope you're going to have, I was going to say great time in Glasgow, but you know what I'm trying to say. I hope we will see an outcome that hopefully won't be too bad, I guess.
Thank you for your time, Chloe, and thank you for listening.